This is an ABC podcast.
Hello from Marlo and good morning. This is Pacific Beat on ABC Radio Australia, coming to you from the lands of the Bunurong and Wurundjeri peoples of the Kulin Nation. Happy Friday to you all. We've got a big show coming up. It is Budget Day in Fiji as the government looks to protect the economy from conflict in the Middle East.
We have to put in policies that anticipate that adverse impact. And so when it happens, when it does translate into that, we will be cushioned.
Also, Australia makes its case as security partner of choice for the Solomon Islands. And rugby league legend Marcus Beyer shares his thoughts on what PNG's NRL team should be called.
For me, I have my own, and maybe a lot of people won't like it.
All that and more coming up. My name's Kyle Evans. Let's get started. But first, Fiji's government is set to present its national budget later this morning, promising investment in jobs, infrastructure and social protections. But as conflict simmers in the Middle East and global oil prices remain volatile, Pacific nations face renewed pressure to shield their economies from external shocks. The ABC's Fiji correspondent Lithe Mavono previews what budgeting for global conflict could look like in the region.
Fiji's budget this year isn't just about balancing books. It's about preparing for a world in crisis. Deputy Prime Minister and Finance Minister Professor Biman Prasad says the 2025-2026 budget will try to insulate Fijians from global pressures that are already starting to bite.
We have to put in policies that anticipate that adverse impact. And so when it happens, when it does translate into that, we will be cushioned and we will ensure that we look after our people in that particular situation.
Economists say Fiji's economy has been recovering well from COVID, with growth and reduced inflation. However, as the war between Iran and Israel heralds a possible period of economic slowdown, the Fiji government is hedging against potential downturns in tourism and remittances, both vital lifelines for island nations.
We also saw good economic growth in the last 2 years. And if we are able to maintain that level of economic growth, and that if we are able to raise the same level of revenue, we are confident that we would be able to keep our debt to GDP ratio below 80%, which is 10% lower than what we inherited when we came into government in 2022, which was above 90%.
For the first time, Fiji's debt to GDP ratio is expected to fall below 80%, down from over 90% when the current coalition government came to power in 2022. But that stability could be tested. Kishti Sen, ANZ Bank's Pacific economist, monitors economic trends across the region and explains how global shocks, especially oil price volatility, could affect island nations.
Yes, there has been a temporary spike in oil prices since the conflict started, but it has returned to where it was before the conflict started. The negative news around a conflict or any war does create the doubt of uncertainty about discretionary expenditure all over the world. So I think that there could be some impact through that channel simply because of the uncertainty and the negative news that surrounds a conflict.
The budget is going to anticipate that the measures are geared to make sure that we are able to deal with any of those, you know, contingencies.
Sen says Pacific countries are now in a transition phase where tourism alone won't drive growth. He says governments must step in to maintain momentum.
So it's a transitional phase where tourism rebuilds capacity and Fiji looks at other industry sectors as sources of growth. I would suggest that a good budget would be one that keeps public demand or expenditure up rather than down.
Fiji's government appeared to be doing just that. Biman Prasad says the budget will continue investment in infrastructure, especially in health and education, and support sectors affected by rising living costs.
I think it will be a very balanced budget. It will be a budget for stability. It will be a budget for prosperity for our people. It will be a budget that will cushion any possible impact of the global economic slowdown. We have made a significant progress in the last 2.5 years. A lot more work still needs to be done, and you will find that this budget continues with that momentum.
But can other Pacific nations follow suit? Both Prasad and Sen say the time to act is now. And that means designing budgets that are socially protective, economically bold, and regionally connected.
It is not a time to hold back on supporting our people. So this is not a time to cut back on expenditure, which will support growth. Plus, I think as a region, we need to keep thinking about a much more deeper, meaningful regional integration.
Time has arrived. How do Pacific Island countries generate more income domestically so that they can sustain strong economic growth into the future? The Pacific is very much an informal economy. How do you put more cash in their pockets so that they can increase their spending power?
Sen also advises governments to be ready to ease fuel costs by adjusting tax policies, especially if inflation spikes again.
If inflation does become a problem, governments certainly can do things. Like, government could take away temporarily some taxes on products in order to provide some respite to people if there is a real cost of living a problem.
The ANZ's Pacific economist Kishti Sen ending that report from Lithe Mavono in Suva.
Pacific Beat.
To the Solomon Islands now, and Australia is seeking to cement its place as security partner of choice with a $20 million package to help the country host the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting in September. In a busy day in Honiara, Australia's Minister for the Pacific, Pat Conroy, made several announcements of funding and support across a range of areas, as well as the Forum Leaders Meeting. Another of his government's priorities is to finalise the implementation of a $190 million commitment to expand the size of the Solomon Islands police force to edge China out of the security space. Our reporter, Kristen Reeder, Amanu Leong, was there for all the announcements, and she joins us now. Chrissy, welcome to the program.
Yeah, good follow morning, Kyle.
Now, to the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting first, what will the $20 million be spent on?
Well, at the end of Mr. Pat Conroy's trip from Fiji, Papua New Guinea, and then to Solomon Islands, he did meet with several government ministers here. It's his fourth visit, rather, to Solomon Islands, and quite a significant one ahead of the Pacific Islands Forum Leaders Meeting that Solomon Islands will be hosting. So among the number of things or announcements that were being made, part of that announcement of $20 million is a large portion of it would go towards roadworks, around $11 million itself. And this is to maintain and upgrade some of the country's roads, particularly the ones here in Honiara, ahead of the Pacific Leaders Summit. So this announcement, of course, brought a lot of smiling faces to commuters here in Honiara, who for many years have been impacted by a worsening state of roads and potholes, especially here in Honiara. So that definitely brought some smiling faces, but the difference, which is roughly around $8 million or so, is to fund about 60 vehicles. This is also to look at the cybersecurity space and other logistical arrangements purposely for the Pacific Islands Leaders Summit that will take place in September here. Mr. Pat Conroy did make it clear as well that this funding has zero conditions attached to it, Kyle.
Yeah, I do remember there were some decent-sized potholes when I was there a couple of years ago. So China's also pledged support for the leaders' meeting. What is it providing, and what has the Solomon Islands government had to say about who will be doing what when it comes to security for the meeting?
Well, since Solomon Islands and China established diplomatic relations in 2019, this gathering, the Pacific Islands Leaders Forum Summit, would be the first test of China's sway in that relationship between the two countries. Earlier this month, we had seen support coming in from China. China's ambassador to Solomon Islands did hand over US 1 million, which is around 1.5 million Australia dollar, and this donation was to buy 27 vehicles, and this is particularly to use for the leaders for this leader for the summit as well. We've seen quite a number of vehicles being handed over, particularly before this. So this was in during the Pacific Games. You might recall a lot of vehicles that were being handed over by different or various development partners. So we're seeing that now with China donating that much for vehicles. But Beijing have been, we've seen Beijing building political influence as well here since that time, and that's something that's quite concerning for Canberra. But at the same time, we've heard from Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele, who has remained consistent in his messaging that Solomon Islands needs to be met by all different development partners and not just for one. So security at this stage is still unclear, Kyle. Who does what at the meeting? That's something we understand is an ongoing discussion with the Forum Secretariat on a range of issues, and that also includes security. But we did hear from Mr. Pat Conroy, the Pacific Minister, where he told the ABC that he has been given reassurance by Prime Minister Jeremiah Manele that Australia will continue to remain the security partner of choice. Mr. Conroy did make it clear also that he does not think China should be involved in policing in the Pacific, saying that it's inconsistent with the PIF leaders' view that Pacific policing should be done by the Pacific. And so these are some of the things when it comes to the security arrangements. We will know for sure when we are close in on that important meeting.
Yeah, really interesting stuff. And Mr. Conroy made several other announcements while in Honiara, I understand. What were they?
Yes, so there was a room filled with many Solomon Islanders. It was interesting because I did pick out a few who had come from travel from the provinces. This is to launch the Australia-Solomon Islands Development Partnership Plan. So it's a direction that Solomon Islands government wants for its people, and Australia has taken that on board and has listened. And this is something for the next 5 years. So after wide range consultations with various stakeholders, so both SALTS and Australia, that is now ready to roll out. So there was a room filled with former recipients of these awards or others who were involved in this development partnership, but that's now carried forward for the next 5 years or so. There was also cake cutting involved, marking a milestone in the Pacific Labour Mobility Scheme. Kyle, for Solomon Islands, there's now 10,000 Solomon Islanders part of the of this PALM scheme, and part of what the economy is benefiting from is the sending of remittances, and that's accounted to about $500,000 Solomon dollars already from now 10,000 Solomon Islanders who are part of the PALM scheme, and that's improving lives here in Solomon Islands. But some of the funding also and some of the announcements from yesterday was directed at mining sector governance and additional support as well to the Tina River Hydro Project, which is the flagship energy project in the country. So lots more announcements there.
I see. And just finally, Chrissy, because we are running out of time, but you mentioned China's policing ambitions a little while ago, but I understand Canberra is also eager to progress a plan to grow the Solomon Islands police force. Did Mr. Conroy have anything to say about that?
Well, he did make some clarification because Prime Minister Manele detailed the ABC around April that there were some differences with the language, and that's still taking time, especially when it comes to the signing of the 190 million security policing initiative between two countries. So Mr. Conroy did clarify that with the discussions that have been held, there's still, he's expecting that there will be, the process will be solved quickly, and he's reassured that Solomon Islands government and its members have told him after this trip that that Australia will still remain the security partner of choice. And with these discussions, he also, it does reflect essentially what he's trying to say is that Australia will still remain part of the security space with Solomon Islands, and that's no dates have been given yet on when the signing will eventually take place. But with the discussions, he is reassured that that will go through a positive trajectory, Kyle.
Oh, that'll be certainly welcome news for the Australian government, that is for sure. Chrissy, that's all we've got time for, but thanks so much for joining us again on Pacific Beat.
Yeah, thank you, Thomas, Kyle.
Tutonga, where the final investigation report into an aircraft accident involving Lulatai Airlines plane in December 2023 has been released. It found there was a number of shortfalls that caused the Saab aircraft to veer off the runway and hit an embankment. Fortunately, none of the 35 passengers were injured, with the report saying crew failed to detect a tripped circuit breaker, wrongly identifying the situation as a hydraulic problem. Marian Kupu caught up with Tanalea Fushimoli, Tonga's Deputy Prime Minister and the Minister responsible for civil aviation.
I think the significance is that this investigation was completely independent and very transparent. Eh? And now we are being provided with the evidence. And with the evidence, and that's where the investigation ends. Eh? It's now up to the Civil Aviation Office to provide a report to the Lulutai Airlines and up to the government to see what's the way forward, and to ensure, continue to ensure safety in the local services that is provided by Lulutai Airlines. And I think that's the significance of it. And it's giving us a lot of things to think about, and especially the lessons that we have learned. Eh? And there could be some issues about maintenance, the capacity of the airline, in terms of the top-level management and the decision-making authorities that they have, the part that the Civil Aviation Office is playing in terms of ensuring that they comply with the regulations, civil aviation regulations, the crew, the training that they are getting. And as the chief investigator was indicating in the beginning, this is not to blame anyone. This is to find the evidence, the facts, and we move on from there to ensure safety of the local aviation industry.
The report into the accident was compiled by Chief Aviation Investigator James Panavuve. Marian Kupu spoke to him following the port's release.
So we just completed the final investigation for the Lulutai Airlines Saab incident. This was made possible with the assistance of the Australian government, the support of the Honourable Deputy Prime Minister and my director as well, the Civil Aviation Office. But that brings the whole investigation to the complete phase of it, and the airline is still working towards mitigating these issues and completing their remedial actions that they did submit to us as well.
So what happened?
The preliminary report that was released last year, just to short track it, the airline did have some issues that did lead to the aircraft veering off and hitting this old fuel insulation bung that was at the airport. And I mean, fortunately enough, no injuries or lives lost, so that's what we could be happy for.
Can you detail, speak more, elaborate on the faults and the issues?
Right. So we just a quick background brief on it. What we realized is there were some shortfalls in the airline regarding maintenance, some crewing issues. It also provided an in-depth analysis that brought up other issues outside of the directly involved factors. In the 50-page final report we have, you'd be able to see, it'll go into detail about more of it. Really, we didn't provide any recommendations because the airline did go ahead and provide remedial actions, so that's positive for us, and it was confidence for us as investigators that the airline actually went ahead and tried to mitigate what had happened and provide a solution moving forward.
Chief Aviation Investigator James Panuve speaking there.
What goes on behind the scenes in Pacific politics and how does it affect us? Polytalk is back to unpack the big questions like, why is it hard to get medicine you need in the Pacific?
It came to a point where he was admitted where he got blood poisoning. He needed antibiotics for that, and that was not available.
Join me, Scott Whitehair, on Polytalk. Tuesday, 9 a.m. PNG time on ABC Radio Australia or wherever you get your podcasts.
Turning to sport now, and Papua New Guinea has appointed a new board of directors to head up its NRL franchise, and it's wasting little time preparing for the 2028 season. Overseeing the players' village and creating commercial opportunities will be among the top orders of business for the seven members, which includes PNG Hunters chairman Stan Joyce and Melbourne Storm legend Marcus Bayer. At the top of the to-do list, however, will be to come up with a new name for the club. To do that, PNG Prime Minister James Marape has tasked the board with launching a competition so the public can come up with ideas. And Marcus Bayer already has one of his own in mind.
For me, I have my own, and maybe a lot of people won't like it, but it's got a good meaning to the relationship that during the Second World War with the Kokoda Track. That's something that we Papua New Guineans, we look at it as, they call them the Fasiwasi angels who does that. And, you know, they said to me, what would be the name? And I said, the only thing that I can think of is the Fasiwasi angels that holds the big relationship between Papua New Guinea and Australia.
Well, look, I can't speak for Papua New Guineans, but I know a lot of Australians would be very moved by the idea of a PNG NRL club paying homage to that World War II relationship. And hey, look, PNG Angels, I can see that. I think there's some logo potential there. But, yeah. What kind of things do you think you'll advocate for to make sure that it's, you know, going in the right direction?
I think, you know, the last 2 days is where the compound or where the players and their wives will be staying. Part of the sale to our Australians and our New Zealanders and overseas players, probably England as well, is where they're going to live and make sure it's safe and as well closer to places, coffee shop, maybe nightclubs, bars and things like that, that the players can come and enjoy in Moresby. Mm-hmm. And that's something that we probably have a look at. And there's a lot of, you know, Stan Joyce, Ian Tarotea, and their experience in where rugby league lies and my experience being a player starting with Melbourne Storm to make it easier for the players to come in and enjoy Port Moresby. And especially their wives and girlfriends providing, I presume, providing employment for these girls, the ladies to come in and say, hey, there's a job for you, go and do, and don't just, you know, sit in the house. Things like that. To me, I look at it this way, there's a lot of great opportunities for business. And, you know, I know that a lot of players, when they're, you know, earning good money, they want to start something for themselves, and there's no other places they can do here.
I like that emphasis you're putting on entertainment. And I say that as somebody who grew up in Canberra and spent my youth going to Bruce Stadium, which I'm sure you've played at. But around that precinct, yeah, there was little to no entertainment. And it was something the city always cried out for. And I think it actually hurt crowd numbers. So I think that's a good direction. Do you think you'll move back to PNG for this role, or do you think you'll be able to do it from Queensland where you live now?
Well, at the moment, my CEO, John Lewins, he said to me, where does this role? And I said, John, I said, boss, I have no idea. I said, until we first meet and see where we are. It is an appointment of a board member. I presume that I'll be still working for K9 to mining and attend to the board. And there will be one or two, what I get now is there'll be one or two in person as a board meeting together. And there'll be the other meetings that will be online to be able to have conversation on the board about what they wanted to do as quickly. But at the moment, I know that I'll be still working for K92 Mining here in Eastern Highlands and Eastern Highlands Province, and then I think the next couple of weeks I'll know as soon as they put things together and with the ARL Commission and of course our bosses and they will let us know what. The chairman will let us know what our roles are, and then we can go from there. Very, 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 very lucky with the understanding CEO that who gave me an opportunity to say, hey, go for it, and you still work for us, but we'll allow you to go and attend the board meetings, fly in, attend the board meeting if it's in Sydney or if it's in Brisbane or if it's in Moresby, and then come back here and work. You continue to do your 4 weeks on and 4 weeks break. So that side of things was really pleasing for me and my family. And I'm putting into perspective of the players coming here, what do they look at in Moresby? That is the question that it's deeply in me, that for those young boys or experienced players, the marquee players that will be coming in 4 years' time, or what do we have for them? So that's something that I'm looking forward to that, and I can participate in the players or being an ex-player, the players' perspective of when you move to another city. That's something we're going to put perspective to the players to come up here and play for us, play for this, 10 to 15 million people here. And that's something that I'm proud of, and, you know, telling my kids, you know, you play for this country, you play for this franchise. It's got a massive meaning. You motivate a lot of young kids who struggle, and maybe 50, 60% of this or 80% of these young kids who struggle, and the only way out is rugby league.
And just on your son, Cooper, yeah, you mentioned that he played for Queensland recently in the under-19 State of Origin men's side. Would you like to see him play for PNG one day? And do you think he would like to play for PNG if he ever got the opportunity?
I'm a Papua New Guinean, but I understand his mother is Australian and New South Wales lady, so I would love to. I would love to for him to come and put it at the jersey I wore with pride. And as well, I understand he can be able to play for Papua New Guinea, but as well be able to play for Australia. And I cannot stop that, but he's going to make his mind up as he grows older. And
Melbourne Storm legend and one of the newly appointed PNG NRL board members, Marcus Bye, and he was speaking there with myself.
Pacific Beat.
To rugby union now, and on July 22nd, the British and Irish Lions will visit Melbourne to take on the First Nations and Pacifica 15, a new team composing of players of Pacific Islander and First Nations heritage. The team is coached by Tongan and former Australian Wallaby star Totai Kefu, and we sent Finau Fanua along to check out the team's jerseys, which are on show at Melbourne's Marvel Stadium.
I'm looking at the jersey right now. It's a combination of teal and white colours. Has some yellow in it, Pacific Islander and Aboriginal art patterns. It looks pretty cool, actually. Very similar to the Moana Pacifica jersey. Actually, right now, the head coach, Totai Kefu, is fronting the media. If you don't know who he is, he's a Wallaby legend, former coach of the Tonga national rugby team. And he actually helped the Wallabies defeat the British and Irish Lions when they toured in 2001. Let's go over and hear what he has to say.
We're all brothers that originated from the Pacific Ocean, you know. The sea is what connects all of us. And we've had this is a great opportunity not only to play together but to represent probably Pacifica players and First Nations players that have played here in Australia in the past.
What do you think you have to do to make it a tradition? You know, fill this stadium. You know, perform well. What's important?
Oh, look, I think performance is our mindset. Like we really want to win. But, you know, we're not thinking too much about the result. The process is what we're going to concentrate on. I think the way we can best represent our people and cultures is by putting on a performance that hopefully get us a good result.
Will there be a war dance or haka?
That's a good question. I don't know. You'll have to ask the cultural advisor. But who knows? Yeah, maybe. It would have to be a mixture between a lot of cultures, so that might be too long.
And with players, have you had to sell it much with players? Have you had sort of pretty good pickup? And how has it sort of gone about finding the different guys for the team?
Well, it's been easy for me. Joe and his Wallaby selectors have pretty much given us a squad. So I've only talked to probably four or five of them on the phone, so we need to probably narrow that squad down a fair bit, which we'll do in the next week or so.
Also here at the event is Andy Muirhead. He's the Brumbies winger.
Yeah.
First Nations man, Burungam man. Muirhead wants to see a regular All-Stars Indigenous team, similar to the one that plays in the rugby league format. That would be awesome, actually, just to have a First Nations team.
Yeah, that's a dream, mate. I think you see how well the All-Stars games of every season go for the NRL, and I'd love to see that happen. Unfortunately, we don't have the numbers playing Super Rugby, and that's a bit of a goal of ours as a game, I think, is to be able to grow our participation, and that sort of flows up into your professional levels, and then you have the numbers to be able to throw together a team. I guess I've mentioned Lloyd McDermott a fair few times. They're very good at doing this. They do a lot of talent ID. And when I was coming up through the senior ranks, we went on a fair few trips where you'd get people from all around Australia and we'll get to travel together as a group, which is quite similar to the team that we're going to put out on the 22nd, obviously with our Pacifica brothers to join us. So it'd be great if we could get that up and running again. I think it's we're a little way off, but I think it's something we could definitely strive to. It'd be good for the game.
Approximately 40,000 fans from the UK and Ireland are expected to arrive here in Australia over the next few weeks to support their beloved Lions. They're very vocal, very passionate, and the pubs will be full, no doubt. The Lions are expected to defeat the First Nations and Pacifica 15 squad, but there's always the possibility of an upset. Well, that's at least according to some of the Pacific Islander fans who turned out for the unveiling today.
They're outside chance, but I think they can get the job done.
How do you feel about Australia having its own Pacifica team?
I think it's a good opportunity, something younger Pacific kids can look forward to making. I think it's a good opportunity for the Pacific kids.
Do you have dreams of playing for the Wallabies? Or
Wallabies or All Blacks?
Japan.
What about Tonga?
Nah.
You know, it's hard to pass judgment on a team that's unknown. The full roster hasn't been released yet, but given the cohesion and quality of the Lions roster, the bookmakers will no doubt have the odds overwhelmingly in the Lions' favor. But you know, Pacific Islander teams, they do have a history of causing massive upsets. It'll be interesting to see what happens on July 22nd.
Be very, very interesting indeed. That was Finau Fanua reporting from Marvel Stadium in Melbourne, where the First Nations and Pacifica 15s unveiled their jerseys yesterday.
Pacific Beat.
Well, Palau is putting the finishing touches to facilities across Karor as it prepares to host the 2025 Pacific Mini Games. This will be the 12th edition of the Games, which with the opening ceremony taking place on Sunday as athletes from 23 Pacific nations compete in 12 sports over 10 days. It will be Palau's second time hosting the Mini Games, with a US $5 million spent on upgrading sports venues and accommodation for athletes. The Palau National Stadium will host the opening and closing ceremonies, and also one of the big draw card events is athletics. Joining us now to preview the event is Tom O'Shaughnessy from Oceania Athletics. Tom, welcome to the program.
Thanks for having me.
Not a problem at all. So, yeah, I do actually want to start with that interesting track. Our only standard only has six lanes, whereas, as we know, in most competitions, there's eight lanes. So does that mean only six athletes are going to progress to the finals on the track and field?
Yeah, it will mean that. We'll have some extra rounds in the 100 and 200 in the semifinals and some extra races there. But it's not uncommon to have six-lane tracks around, especially around the Pacific and around the world. It's for smaller federations and smaller countries. It's an ability to have a track that they may not be able to. Cook Islands have a six-lane track currently, and they've hosted the mini games previously as well.
Okay. Does it sort of make for, you know, better races in some ways? Because I imagine, you know, there's less spots, more higher end talent and things like that. Is it sort of better from that point of view?
It will make it tough in 100, 200 and 400. There's only six lanes in the final, so there's only six people going through instead of the usual eight people. So it'll make it tougher and it'll make it harder. So if there's three PNG athletes, it could be two countries represented in terms of athletes in the final with three athletes from each country able to enter.
So can you tell us what's at stake for these Pacific mini games? Are these qualifiers for a bigger event?
They will have some qualification aspects to it. Most federations, most countries that are eligible to go to the World Championships will be selecting their one universality athlete to go to the World Championships later on in Tokyo in September. So there'll be some consequences out of that. I think the biggest showdown that we'll see over the week in athletics will be the men's 100 metres with both PNG national record holders, Pius Whistle and Tavatina Tuna, lining up in that one, and that'll be a fantastic race. Probably the two fastest athletes, Pacific Island athletes, ever to race each other.
Yeah, really exciting. Out of curiosity, just given that six lane format, if they were to sort of break a record or something like that, would that technically be recorded in bigger events?
Yeah, that still counts. It still can get a classification, a certification from World Athletics. So that's all fine and that's all above board. It's a 100-metre track. It's 400 metres around. So that's all fine. Records will stand. And that it just means that it's only six lanes. And so there's only six athletes in the final.
Yeah, interesting. Now, just for people who might not know, why is it important to have these smaller international events for Pacific athletes? And I suppose not only that, what separates the mini games from the Pacific Games normal?
I suppose the number of sports is the big thing, and that enables a smaller country like Palau to host them, and they're doing a fantastic job. I know I've been speaking to the local athletics federation, the National Olympic Committee, who's been organising. They've done a great job. They've obviously had a massive investment in terms of financial dollars to be able to upgrade the track and a number of other venues around Palau, including the schools, to host everyone. And so I think they're really looking forward to it. If they had 24 sports from the big games, it means they wouldn't be able to have everyone come there. And the mini games gives an opportunity to smaller federations and smaller countries to host something. And it's a great legacy piece in terms of not just the facilities, but their technical officials, their coaches will get upskilled over these, over the last few months and over the games, that they'll be able to host more competitions, both locally, regionally, and Oceania-wide as well.
And I had read some reports leading into the event that some teams were having some administrative issues prior to the games. Has every team that initially registered, were they all able to make it in the end?
Yeah, I believe so. I believe all 24 PGCs will be in attendance into Palau. There's always difficulties getting anywhere in the Pacific in terms of travel. It's not an easy place to get around the Pacific, as most of the listeners will understand that. And I know that there's been a big push by a lot of PGCs to make sure that we get as many athletes there as possible. And in just athletics, we'll have over 200 athletes, which is a fantastic achievement.
Now, speaking of some of that competition, let's look ahead to that now. Which athletes and from which countries do you think we should all keep an eye on?
As I mentioned, I think the men's 100 obviously is always the men's and women's 100s are always a blue ribbon event. But I think one that's probably not normally looked at is the men's high jump. We'll have three athletes over 2 metres, including the recently Fiji national record holder, Rasai Matai, who's jumped 2.10 this year, 2.10 metres, and a young Cook Island athlete, Samisoni Hewitt, who's jumped 2.05, and he's the national record holder there. So I think that'll be a really exciting competition with no pole vault. That'll be the high jump. So that'll be a fantastic spectacle in Palau, and I'm really looking forward to that.
High jump is one of those sports that I always find it's great to watch live. Out of curiosity, I know you mentioned sort of the 100 and 200 meter sprint before as I guess the blue ribbon events. Is there a showcase sport that's particularly loved by Palau? Like, I think back to when I was in the Solomon Islands for the Pacific Games, and obviously, you know, soccer was by far and away the number one sport. Is there an equivalent in Palau?
Yeah, I suppose throughout Micronesia, baseball's a massive sport, and baseball will be massive in Palau. I think they've got a good, strong team from what I understand. Baseball, obviously not a traditional Pacific Island sport, but definitely massive in Micronesia. I know going to the Micronesian Games a couple of times, it's definitely a really big sport, and that'll be a really big draw card to see all the Micronesian countries, Guam, FSM, Northern Marianas. They'll all have teams. Solomon Islands and Fiji, I believe, are also featuring. So I think that'll be a really big draw card for people coming and watching watching the sports. I think athletics will draw a big crowd, but baseball will be the other one.
And just finally, Tom, we mentioned some of those infrastructure upgrades in the introduction. How are they all looking?
I believe they're all open. I believe they've had some ceremonies over the last couple of days, and everything's open, and athletes are starting to come and use them for training. And obviously, we start on Sunday with the opening ceremony at the National Stadium. And then on to competition throughout the next week and a half. So they're all open and ready to go. Everything's getting in the final preparations now with I know teams starting to arrive. I think there's a couple of charters starting to arrive in the next couple of days, probably even today even. And so that, I think that's really exciting for Palau and getting the facilities ready.
I certainly can't wait to see how it all unfolds. Tom, that's all we've got time for, but thanks so much for joining us today on Pacific Beat.
Thanks for having me.
And that does bring us to the end of Pacific Beat. Thanks for joining us today. You can hear us again at 5 p.m. PNG time. Stay tuned on ABC Radio Australia, because the news is next. And coming up after that is Nija Daily. We'll be back on Monday morning. That'll be with Dagi Tupo. Have a fantastic day.
Salo Falava, I'm Afamasanga Seyuli Salamasina Von Reiki, and I'm inviting you to join me on a journey through the evolution of our Pacific cultures on Culture Compass. We'll meet incredible people dedicated to preserving traditions while adapting them for today's world. Join me as we travel the Pacific to celebrate our resilience, revival, and deep-rooted connection.
Search for Culture Compass wherever you get your podcasts to listen.